lifting out of the swell and skipping across the breaking waves like a flying fish. The slender nacelles containing the anti-grav plates extended out from the skiff's sides. "Turn in! Turn in!" Priad yelled, his voice lost in the roar. But Pindor, at the helm, read his gesture. Still crouched at the prow, Priad looked back at Diognes. "Draw a lance," Priad said. Diognes crouched with his legs wide to ride out the buffets and slid a sea lance from the rack. 2 meters of polished stone with a long spine of razor-sharp adamite projecting from the tip. He passed it deftly to Priad. "Draw another and wait," Priad said. He settled in the prow with the lance against his hip, the tip projecting out across the bows. "Worm! Worm sounding!" Diognes hollered. It came up out of the ocean 50 meters behind the squadron of hunting skiffs, pluming sheets of spray from the edges of its interlocking horny plates. 20 meters out of the water, barely a third of its whole length. A maturing sub-adult. Its bone-armored skull, the size of a dropship, opened to expose a white maw and articulate translucent fangs that were longer than a sea lance. It called. The subsonic note blasted them with ultrasound. Then it writhed and fell back into the sea with the detonating force of an earthshaker salvo. Tidal waves smashed out from its impact. But Priad wasn't looking at it. He was gazing ahead at Lacres Stilt. Ulbrumid was boiling at the base of the rock stack, and high up on the flattened top stood a lone figure. Chiron. The Ulbrumid broke, and a worm coiled up around Lacres Stilt. A mature female by its silvery plates, 140 meters long. Horn plates glistening, it wrapped around the rock pillar, rising. A second worm came up, a juvenile male, 80 meters long. It locked around the female, writhing up around her, trying to constrict her into the rock with its coils. The worms snapped and sounded at each other, snouts banging against snouts. The ultrasound of their calls percussively dimpled the sea swell, causing back waves and eddies. The skiff wobbled, but Pindor steadied them and curved them in. Priad raised his lance and made the hand-down sign to Pindor that meant slow. Ulbrumid boiled in the water ahead, rocking the skiff. In a surge of foam, the flat arrow-shaped head of a worm broke the surface, jaws open. It was another juvenile, but big enough to swallow them whole. Priad rose on the casting deck in the broad, braced stance of the Lowscray and cast his lance. It tore into the beak bone before falling away into the sea. The worm broke the water and went down out of view. "Draw me!" Priad cried. Diognes reached a fresh sea lance into his waiting grip. "All specs! It's running under us! 10 meters! About! About!" Pindor turned the skiff hard. Priad watched the water braced, the lance ready. His arm was pulled back, and the tip of the sea lance was beside his ear. The worm broke again, running the surface. Priad saw the horn plate slicing through the chop as it slid under. He cast again. The sea lance went right into the worm's side between the plates. The water went dark around them. "Hold on!" Priad yelled, grabbing the side ropes. The worm's death frenzy stormed the water into a chaos. They were lifted clean out of the sea by a blow from the writhing tail. "On! On!" Priad cried. Pindor pulled on the helm to correct and powered them out of the death froth. Priad looked back in time to see one of Strabos's skiffs thrown up out of the water and splintered to kindling by a mature female. He saw bodies flailing, falling. The worm lunged and took the lancecaster out of the air like a feline snatching a dangled treat. Hurling lances from his casting deck at the prow, Strabo turned his skiff back desperately to assist his worm-taken boat. "Cylon!" hissed Priad over the vox. "In! Oi!" The 2 skiffs of Damocles ran in towards Lacres Stilt. Diognes passed a fresh lance to Priad. There were 3 left in the other rack. Priad looked up at Chiron, forlorn on the top of the stack. Below him, the mature female and the juvenile male were locked in mating combat, cracking the stone as their coils tightened. The smaller, fatter male bit its fangs deep into the female's back. In response, she shuddered and swung her sinuous head around, ripping out the male's throat with her vast blade teeth. Dead, the male collapsed back into the sea, its ropes of coil slackening. The weight of its impact threw up a swell that capsized both Damocles' skiffs. Priad spluttered as they righted. He was still holding the 3rd lance. The female had gone. Priad looked around. There was no sign of her. Had the juvenile injured her so badly? She had withdrawn. Priad looked up at Chiron. The apothecary was standing at the lip of Lacris Stilt, looking down. He disappeared for a second, and then reappeared, running. Chiron threw himself off the stilt top and closed his body into a perfect diving shape. He hit the water like a missile. A 30-meter dive into Marisay, into white water. Not even the best, Priad thought. Brother Sergeant, Diagnes called. What? Hard return, 12 meters, rising. Priad scanned the water. There was a flash of foam. Chiron surfaced, spluttering and coughing, 50 meters ahead of them. Pindar, swing us in! Brother Sergeant, Diagnes called again. Hard return! Huge echo, 6 meters astern! Priad looked back. He saw the Ulbrumid. Saw the size of it. This wasn't the female returning. This was why the female had fled. A mature male. A giant bull. Claritaya. Chapter 6. Priad leaned over the bow and grabbed the floundering Chiron by the arm. Struggling, he heaved the half-dead apothecary up over the gunwale. Cylon's skiff closed in to assist. The Claritaya broke the surface behind them. Even old Pindor cried out in alarm. It was an old, old bull, a 300-meter monster. Its girth matched the widest rock stack. Its huge skull seemed the size of a battle barge. It towered above them, cascading water from its ancient plates, opened its maw, and exposed 5-meter-long fangs. It sounded. The surface water was blitzed into drizzle. Both crews fell down in agony, holding their ears. The hardwood casting deck of Priad's skiff cracked. The bull surged forward, forepart raised out of the water. Cylon threw a lance that bounced off the plate and then snatched a fresh one from Xander. He threw again. It was a perfect cast. The lance punctured between the third and fourth plates and lodged fast. The old bull didn't even seem to feel it. Priad dragged Chiron onto the casting deck and turned to pick up his lance. The vast worm was right on them. Priad seized another lance and cast it hard. It struck the bull's nose scales and quivered away. Draw me, Priad yelled, but Diagnes was leaning back to throw the next lance himself. Cursing, Priad stooped and pulled the last remaining lance free from the rack. Diagnes cast. The lance went clean into the bullworm's right eye. It shuddered and writhed back. Priad had the final lance in his hands. He pulled his arm back and threw. It went right down the worm's gaping throat. As it fell, as it died, the bullworm blasted up vast wakes of water that smashed the skiffs aside and broke them on the stilts. The plume of worm blood spread and marked the water for a kilometer square. The hookbeaks and scalebirds rioted down to feed in their thousands. Chapter 7. Ithaca. Proud Ithaca. Ocean world. Cradle of snakes. The apothecary kneels in the surf on the beach as the moon rises between the stacks of the Primarch's causeway. Waves break around his bulky armored form. He fills the 10 copper flasks with the life water of the homeworld. It is time to ship out. The battle barge awaits to carry them to a new undertaking. This is the last act before leave-taking, the rite of the claiming of water. The apothecary intones the litany, and the men of Damocles' squad, each one in full armor, circle around him at the waterline, making the ritual responses. He hands each one his flask of life water. The last two go to the newest inductees, standing proudly in their polished warplate. Diognes. Akon. The rite is done. The apothecary stands, screws up the stopper of his own flask, and slides it into his thigh pouch. Ready, brother apothecary? Asks Priad.
I'm ready, brother sergeant,
says Chiron. Of Damocles. Part 6. Blue Blood. Undertaking to Iorgu. Chapter 1. Bright as a serrated knife, daylight winking off its ridged bows, the imperial barge fell away behind them, until it was just a dwindling star beginning to set in the western sky. Far below, the shadow of their landing ship jittered and skipped as it pursued them across the parched, pink wilds of Iorgu. The land was cracked like scurf skin, or like beach sand that had baked and crazed in the sun after the tide had withdrawn. Priad knew enough about Iorgu to understand that these seabeds had been dry for eons and no tide would ever return. Every few dozen kilometers, they overflew a desert town or settlement, little clusters of white domes like brooches of pearls pressed into the pink dunes, or strung out along the lips of red rock canyons, bone white as crusts of air-dried salt. The lander shivered as altitude thrusters crimped and fired, nudging them northward. As the angle changed, rungs of golden sunlight stole in through the portholes and washed like slow liquid across the faces of the men on the starboard side. The warriors of Damocles' squad were seated in restraint thrones, back to back, five looking to port, five to starboard. They wore full Astartes war gear, except that their heads were bare. The 10 grim-visored helmets were suspended in hydraulic clamps above their thrones. Their weapons were locked in racks underneath their arm braces. Priad slowly tore his gaze away from the desiccated landscape flashing by below and consulted the luminous red screen of the data plate above his window. Bearing, height, airspeed, time to set down.
2 minutes, he said. Activate armor.
A series of low whines answered him as 10 M37 dorsal-mounted power units woke up. Priad immediately felt an enervating vigor throb in his ceramide-sheathed limbs, the reassuring surge of inhuman strength.
Is vital monitoring satisfactory, Brother Chiron?
I have 10 steady life beats, Brother Sergeant, replied the squad's apothecary promptly.
90 seconds, said Priad. Lock armor.
Hydraulics hissed and clanked. The 10 helmets lowered onto the heads of the Marines. Most of the men wore their hair tied back or braided over their scalps, ready for helmet fit. But Priad noticed how young Diognes deftly scooped his glossy mane of black ringlets up under the lip of the descending helmet before it met the neck seal and secured. Priad's own helmet clicked into place, and abruptly he was breathing cool, internal air supply and seeing everything through the bright green display of his visor optics.
Auto weapons check,
Priad instructed, his voice an electronic murmur carried by the intersuit vox. The individual data plates before them scrolled with diagnostic reports fed from their racked arsenal.
Run auto-sense target trial, he said.
The plates flickered with rapid test patterns that measured and calibrated each Marine's targeting systems. Through his visor optics, Priad locked up 6 vary-range practice icons as they appeared on his data plate, freezing each one in turn with a hard, white graphic cross. Satisfied, the plate responded by displaying a default Aquila symbol. He muttered a prayer of thanks.
Set down positions, Priad said finally.
The thrones tightened their grips, clamping limbs, torsos, and necks, and rotating slightly into the lock-up position so that each space marine was firmly cradled and tilted back. As the thrones reclined, segmented blast shutters closed like eyelids over the window ports, shutting out the light. 30 seconds. Priad switched his visor display to access the view through the lander's forward pict readers. He saw emerald crags and a lime-green sky rushing past him, overlaid with rapidly changing graphics of trajectory, contour, and flight path prediction. A column of numerical data crawled up the left side of the panorama. Priad knew the emerald rocks were really pink, and the lime sky really smoke blue, but when the city came into view at last, he longed to know what color that truly was. Outposts at first. Wide-spaced lines of towers set in the ragged basalt like fangs rising from a meatless jawbone. Thin ribbons of highways radiating out from the city. An outer ring wall, tall and crenellated, then a great shadow-filled ditch that the highways crossed on stilted stone viaducts. Steps of stone-built walls forming irrigated terraces teeming with lush daum trees. Then Iorgu City. 500-meter curtain walls, sloping gently inwards, smooth as ice. Defense towers sprouting like stalagmites from the wall's upper levels. Beyond the cyclopean wall, the hazy vista of the inner city. Towers and steeples and domes clustered around the gigantic landmarks of the Imperial Basilica, the Royal Palace, the steeple of the Astropathica, and, in the distance, the Sacred Mound, the only soft, organic shape in sight. The city was so vast that Priad was soon unable to take it all in with one look, despite the 180-degree sweep of his scope. A jolt. Braking jets. A rolling sensation of weightlessness as they decelerated hard, swinging south on a sustained burn of vertical thrusters. Now some of the towers were climbing past them, dwarfing them. Down below, on a wide platform of rockcrete, 90 meters above the city floor, a star of landing lamps began to strobe flash, the lights pulsing along the arms of the star towards the center. Another judder of jets. A lurch. 50 meters. 20. 10. 2. There was a noise like an iron shutter falling, a violent jarring, and then they were down. "Damocles, disengage and deploy," Priad cried. The thrones slammed back to vertical. Power feeds, monitor plugs, and restraints disengaged in a series of pings and clangs. The hatches opened, lifting like trap doors, 5 along each flank of the lander, and daylight flooded in. Sliding their weapons from the throne side racks, Damocles' squad strode out into the bright heat on the landing pad. This wasn't a combat zone, and they weren't expecting trouble, but even so, they dismounted from the lander in standard assault pattern, covering each address with their bolters, sweeping and hunting for targets until Priad gave the word, and they locked off their weapons and slung them up. The 5 men on each side turned and marched around behind the lander, coming together like the teeth of a zip to form a precise double file. Dust swirled around them. They waited a moment as Brother Andromach raised the chapter standard and fixed it between his shoulder blades so that it fluttered above his head. Then Chiron performed the water rites. "Advance," said Priad, as soon as the ritual was done. Ceramite-shod feet, marching in perfect synchronicity, rang on the rockcrete. The great brass iris hatch on the edge of the pad opened as they strode towards it. A tall, white-bearded man in an ornately braided dark jacket and white jodhpurs came out to meet them, flanked by an escort of 60 heavy guardsmen in patterned silk, spiked helmets with silver avon tails, and salute-raised linstocks. The guardsman immediately to the officer's right held up a massive parasol of white canvas and rosewood to provide shade for his commander.
"I am Sir Askia Duxel of the Interior Guard," the bearded man said.
His face was lined from years in the sun, and nictitating augmetic filters of smoked plastic had slid down over his eyeballs.
"It is my honor to welcome the hallowed Astartes Iron Snakes to Iorgu City."
"The honor is mine, Sir Askia,"
Priad saluted, switching his suit fox to speaker. His voice rumbled across the open pad.
"We have come to do homage to your king."
Chapter 2
"I had wished for more,"
Priad had said in the dim, tranquil vaults of the chapter house on Charybdis.
10 months have I spent, reforging Damocles into a fighting unit, and we are ready. But the inductees, Diogenes and Akon, have never seen actual combat, and Chiron, though I count myself blessed to have him as apothecary, has not worked with the squad in the field. I had wished, I was hoping, for a combat mission."
"I trust, Brother Sergeant, that every Iron Snake hopes his next task will be a combat mission."
Profoundly deep, and without the merest glimmer of light, the voice of the chapter master had welled across Priad like the deep oceanic volume of proud Ithaca.
"Of course, my master,"
Priad had said hurriedly. He had not intended offense.
"We are sworn to duty, the duty of the Astartes, enfranchised to us by the God Emperor of our race. We undertake each duty as it comes, and we do not question it."
Priad had bowed his head.
"No, of course not, my master."
For a long moment, Chapter Master Sadon of the Iron Snakes had remained silent, a gigantic shadow in the dim light of the temple.
"Our duty is to serve the Emperor,"
Sadon had intoned suddenly.
"Our specific duty is to protect the Reef Stars. Iorgu is a principal world in that region, a proud bastion of Imperial power. I lament that a long, wise rule of Queen Gartrude has come to an end. It is appropriate for our chapter to send an emissary guard to attend the coronation of her successor. It would be disrespectful for the Iron Snakes to ignore the event.
I realize that, my master.
I have chosen Damocles to perform this duty. To march in the coronation train. To witness the crowning of the new king. To represent our interests and demonstrate both our unswerving loyalty and the permanence of our vigil. Do you question that choice?
No, my master. I was only saying that I would have wished for something less ceremonial.
I would have tasked you to combat Priad, but the reef is quiet for now. I know how you yearn to baptize and test your squad in fire. Do this for me now, and I will find you your crucible. How say you?
Priad's pulse had been thudding in his temples. He had managed a smile.
Damocles will go to Iorgu, my master, he had promised.
We will get fat and slow, Brother Xander blurted, dropping his helmet and then his gauntlets onto a chaise. Until Diognes and Akon had been inducted, Xander had been the youngest of Damocles, and he still liked to act the firebrand.
Fat and slow, echoed Brother Pindar as he disengaged his own helmet.
Really?
Figuratively, snapped Xander. Pageants, pomp, feasting. This isn't what we were made for.
Cylon and Andromach growled their agreement.
I tell you what, Xander, said Chiron,
disconnecting his gauntlets and flexing his bared hands thoughtfully.
This is precisely what we were made for.
Xander frowned at the apothecary. Chiron had an excellent reputation, and no one in Damocles' squad questioned his ability, but he was still a newcomer, a stranger in the place of beloved Memnes. They were still getting used to his straight-talking wisdom.
How so?
Xander asked.
I suppose, said Chiron, that you long for battle?
That is our calling, Xander nodded.
When the God Emperor wishes it. It is our forte, but not our calling.
Chiron turned to face Xander. The young, dark-braided warrior had a proud, glacial face and towered a full head's height above the grey-haired apothecary with his narrow eyes and jut-jawed, bear-trap frown.
Our calling is the Emperor's service, brother boy. He wills that we fight. We fight. He wills that we stand respect to a coronation. We stand respect. He wills it that we support a toppling temple on our shoulders. We brace and take the weight. And if he tells us to strip naked and stand on our heads, that we do too. That is what we were made for. To serve the will of the Emperor.
Xander looked away.
I stand chastised, brother apothecary Chiron.
Chiron chuckled and smacked the warrior's arm plates.
You just stand, Xander. That's all he asks.
The area is secure, Natus reported to Priad.
The sergeant nodded. The area was secure. The area was also dripping with opulence. 5 communicating private apartments on the 60th floor of the Iorgian Palace, draped in silks and Koshiori embroiderwork, lit by glow globes and glass-fluted wick lamps. Every item of furniture was gilded and carved. Vast windows of tinted glass overlooked the city sprawl below.
We are their honored guests, Priad murmured.
What is this?
Asked Brother Akon, regarding with some confusion a soft heap of cushions and silk-cased bolsters.
A bed, replied Priad.
For sleeping?
Indeed. There are 10 of them, 2 in each room.
Salt of Ithaca,
Akon said.
I would drown in that softness. The Iorguans don't really understand what we are, do they, Brother Sergeant?
Said Chiron.
They give us beds and fine staterooms.
And food, said Priad, gesturing to a long side table where platters of fruits, breads, and sweetmeats were arrayed.
The bioengineered metabolisms of the Astartes warriors could go without conventional rest or regular food for weeks. If pushed, a 20-minute restorative nap, which could be taken upright with armor locked, and an intravenous nutrient pack could prolong their operational capacity.
We are gods to them, Priad said. Legends from the stars. Most citizens of the Imperium go their whole lifetimes without seeing one of our kind in the flesh. They presume us to be men, yet fear us as deities of war.
I would not disabuse them of either notion, said Chiron.
Maybe you see now why our attendance here carries so much weight, Priad said to Xander. Why even 10 of our chapter coming here and paying homage to the new king is a significant event. The folk of Iorgu will remember this time. The day the Adeptus Astartes set foot
on Iorgian soil, in person, to acknowledge their king. At nightfall, a nervous troop of palace guards came and summoned them to audience. The sky outside had turned purple, and the golden towers of the city glimmered in the last rays of the setting sun. Damocles had polished their armor to a sheen and wiped away the last traces of dust. A terrible hush fell on the huge audience hall as they marched in, three abreast, with Priad at the head. 5,000 people, nobility, dignitaries, city lords and servants, gazed at them in awe. Trumpets suddenly blared a fanfare, and many people jumped. Led by Seraskia Duxel, a royal party approached to inspect them. Various silk-wrapped nobles with tall, soft hats, beautiful concubines in costumes made only of precious stones, brute bodyguards who looked like youths next to the towering, immobile space marines. And the king-elect, Naldo Benexa Tashari Iorgu Stam, by the grace of the Golden Throne. A boy, Priad noted with disappointment, just a chinless, excited boy with a too long neck and watery, inbred eyes. The furs and gold that clad him were worth the annual economy of some frontier colonies, and were so heavy teams of silver-painted children had to carry the train. Naldo himself floated on a suspensor plate that served him across the tiled floor.
"I am honored," he said,
his voice nasal and reedy,
"that you, mighty warriors, attend me here."
"Lord King," Priad said,
tilting his head to look down at his majesty. Priad's words rolled like distant thunder from his suit's speakers, and some of the guests shivered or gasped.
"In the name of Sadon, master of the Iron Snakes, in the name of the God Emperor of Mankind, and in the name of my beloved chapter, I greet you and do you homage."
He knelt, power armor joints whirring softly. Even on one knee, he was at eye level with King-elect Naldo. His majesty's face was a pale green blob in Priad's optics. Unbidden, automatic target graphics framed Naldo's visage with white crosshairs. Priad dismissed his visor's treasonous suggestion, and the icon vanished. Naldo was looking up and down the ranks of Damocles with adolescent delight.
"You are all the stories speak of, and more. Giant warriors, all identically cast from the same great pattern."
Priad hesitated. Identical? How could this child not see the differences? Diognes and Xander, tall like oaks. Cools, short and broad. Old Pindor and the noble bearing of Chiron. Acon, thick-set. Natus with his bionic arm. Cylon, whip-thin and supple as a lance. Andromach, sturdy like a sea cliff. "We are meaningless," he thought. "A cipher. That's how they all see us. Interchangeable giants, replications without character. The war gear masks us so."
"Rise, warrior,"
Naldo said, relishing the opportunity to give a space marine an order. Priad got up.
"Join our festivities. Mingle freely."
The king-elect and his entourage moved away. Conversation began to start up again, and musicians began to play.
"Mingle," Priad voxed, suit to suit. "What in the Emperor's name does that mean?"
Chapter 3. They stood attentive and still for 2 hours as the gala swirled around them. Some guests ventured close and admired them as if they were statues. A few stole closer and risked touching their armor for good fortune or simply on a dare. Damocles didn't move. Priad spent his time fixing and logging faces. His optic gaze wandered through the thickets of the crowd, blink recording and tagging each face and figure he saw and adding them to his suit's internal memory. Not only persons, but the structure and dimension of the hall, the number and site of the exits, the position of the band. A warrior of the fratry was taught to assess and catalogue his location for tactical purposes wherever possible, usually a quick matter of key points. Now, he had time to waste. The number of valves or strings on each instrument, the number of frets, the number of buttons on a jacket or gemstones on a gown train, the number of facets on a wine glass, the number of beads on the chandeliers. He logged and identified the robust commander of the local PDF, flamboyant in red satin robes. 5 subsector governors and their staffs. Lord Militant Farnsey, two Navy Commodores, and a cluster of Guard officers who, like Damocles, had been sent to the coronation to represent their institutions. The Princess Royal of Cartomax, a beautiful young woman with a surgically perfect face framed by the gauzy fields of a personal force veil, and perfect breasts pushed up and out in a balcony of diamonds. The Imperial Hierarch, Bishop Ozokomo, his bulk supported on grav plates, his extravagant mitre 3 meters tall. A ranking emissary of the Navis Nobilitae, wearing a holographic face to hide his unseemly third eye. 9 senior adepts of the Guild Astropathicus. The chief clerk of the Administratum Iorgu, with 16 higher recollectors. 6 merchant princes. A man in black robes which did not completely hide his golden prosthetic hand. Priad jolted.
Andromach.
Brother Sergeant.
You have charge here?
Yes, sir.
Priad strode across the packed room. Men and women, the cream of Iorguan society, fled out of his path, aghast that one of the statues was now moving. Priad ignored their whispers and exclamations, and headed for the rear exit of the great hall. The man in black robes had made a hasty retreat in that direction. The outer passageway was dim and quiet, though Priad's optics saw into the shadows as if it was day. He drew his bolter. An ammo load tally immediately appeared on his visor display, alongside a floating target cross. He stalked along the passage, studying every centimeter of the lime-cast view, from the dark teal of the coldest, deepest shadows to the fizzling white flares of the lamp reeds. A tall figure in black stepped out from behind a pillar to face him. Hands, one gloved, one gold, came up and pulled the hood of the black robe down. White hair, an angular, pinch-skinned face.
"Well met, Brother Sergeant," said Inquisitor Mabuse.
"You make no attempt to hide from me," Priad said, disconcerted, wondering if he should prepare for some Ordo trick, some Ordo magic.
Mabuse smiled, revealing small, neat, white teeth.
"I am an Inquisitor, Brother Sergeant Priad. My business is looking and finding and revealing, and knowing how well others do the same. There is small point in a mere mortal trying to conceal himself from an Astartes warrior."
"Yet you fled the hall as soon as I saw you."
"When we last met, on Ceres, we did not part on cordial terms. I suspected, perhaps, that, seeing me, you intended me some harm."
Priad was insulted by the idea.
"I am a servant of the Golden Throne, Inquisitor. I do not indulge in spite or petty retribution against another of the Emperor's servants, despite what I might think of them."
Mabuse nodded.
"Yet your weapon is drawn, and armed, and pointing at me."
Priad realized it was. Annoyed with himself, he locked the safety and holstered the bolter.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked, bluntly.
"In this passageway? In truth, brother, I withdrew from the hall so that we could speak privately."
"I meant—"
Mabuse held up his delicate golden hand to interrupt.
"This is important, Priad. Only you know my true name and calling. The court of Iorgu knows me as Sire Damon Tarade, a sericulture merchant. I would like to retain that disguise a while longer."
"No one will hear the truth from me, or from my men."
Mabuse nodded again, pleased.
"That is good. Thank you, Brother Sergeant.
Now, will you answer my question less literally?"
"Of course. Come."
Warily, Priad followed the Inquisitor into an alcove between thick basalt columns where light reeds fizzled and glowed. Mabuse raised his golden hand again, and the little finger detached with a tiny click and hovered beside them at shoulder height on a beam of repulsor energy. Priad's visor view suddenly fogged and scrambled.
"Open your visor,"
he heard Mabuse say, his words dulled by Priad's armor. Priad undid the magna lock and removed his helmet, looking down into Mabuse's eyes.
"Don't worry,"
Mabuse said, gesturing lightly to his hovering digit.
"It's generating an anti-vox picked field around us so we can speak openly. There is danger here, Priad."
"Danger? What danger?"
Mabuse shrugged.
"I don't know. Not yet. I've been here 6 weeks since the old queen died.
It is standard practice for the Inquisition to send a representative to investigate the death of any significant imperial potentate, and Queen Gartrude, may the Emperor gather her to himself, was certainly that.
Foul play?
Oh, most certainly. She was murdered. But in such an exquisitely subtle way, it looked like the action of old age.
Murdered?
Yes, the Medici Royal missed the signs, but I am certain.
Then it must be reported. It must.
Mabuse reached out with his golden hand and rested it on Priad's armored sleeve. It was a curiously bold yet informal gesture, and Priad fell silent at once, out of surprise more than anything else.
Knowing she was murdered is not the point, Brother Sergeant. Knowing why and by whom is the job of the Inquisition.
The boy, the new king, he would have most to gain, said Priad.
Mabuse chuckled.
You are a greater warrior than I will ever be, Brother Sergeant Priad, but you are no detective.
Hush.
King-elect Naldo is not the culprit. Of that I am assured. I had considered that possibility. No, the regicide is down to someone else. Person or persons as yet unknown. I have suspicions. I may be able to act on them soon. For now, I simply wish to broker peace between us, Priad. Indulge me and keep my mission secret. When the time comes, I may have need of the mighty Iron Snakes.
Chapter 4. That night, once the duties in the great hall were done, Damocles went without rest. In the lamp-lit gloom of the apartments provided for them, they waited and loitered, war gear loosened or partially stripped off. Some talked into the night. Others ate and drank from the rich fares provided just for the novelty. Xander hand-wrestled with Akon and Andromach. Old Pindor played a game of regicide with Cylon. Priad watched them move the pieces across the inlaid board. How inappropriate, he thought to himself. He opened a glazed brass hatch and let himself out onto the balcony that terraced their apartment level. The night was warm, with the scents of June orchids and exhaust fumes on the dry desert air. Straits of silvery cloud barred the moon and shone against a sky as dark and purple as fresh heart muscle. Lit by a soft amber radiance, the city lurked beneath him. Dots of light, the running lamps of air traffic, muddled along the canyons of street below. Occasionally, a higher altitude transport hummed past, soaring between the gilded spires. Priad rested his bare hands on the balcony rail and looked down. The lights of the traffic made a long, glittering river, like a Craratyr, a giant bullworm rising to bask.
Brother?
It was Chiron. The noble apothecary had teased out his mane of grey hair, so it fell around his wide shoulders.
Chiron, we must be on our guard for trouble.
I knew there was something on your mind. What kind of trouble?
We'll know it when it comes.
There was a low grumble. Priad wondered if Chiron had growled something. Then a distant flash, and another grumble. Thunder. Priad heard a tapping sound. Rain, heavy drops of it, was beginning to fall. There would be, Seraskia Duxel explained, 4 days of celebration. 4 daily rituals and observances leading to the full coronation. Damocles would walk in the van of the great procession on each of those days as the rites were performed. On the first day, the king-elect would march to the imperial basilica at the head of an entourage of 10,000 worshippers, and there his suitability would be judged using the ancient treasures of Iorgu. 10 million citizens would line the streets and praise him. Priad asked about the rain. Unusual, the Seraskia admitted. The rains only came once every few decades, but a good portent, nevertheless. The uproar of the procession was worse than any battle. Horns and trumpets blared, and cymbals clashed. The millions cheered and strewed their way with palm fronds cut fresh from the daum trees. Glittering regiments of Imperial Guard and PDF flowed down the main boulevards of the city, escorting nobles in lift litters and motor limousines, columns of tracked war machines, bands of painted dancers, and packs of glabrous sandsloth, swinging their massive heads and barking as their jockeys cropped and goaded their wrinkled flanks. During the long and tedious ceremony at the basilica, thunder rolled again, and a fume of aurora lights flushed the darkening sky. The citizenry moaned and howled in awe at this great sign. By the time Bishop Osakomo got to the verses where the treasures were to be brought forth, rain was hammering on the roof dome and streaming like molten glass down the multicolored windows. The stained light in the basilica shifted and danced. The treasures were unimpressive. A crown, an orb, a scepter, a torque, ancient things that were only brought out for coronations. They were the heirloom legacies of the first monarchs of Iorgu, preserved for all time in the sacred mound where the founding colony had built its original fastness. Apparently, they possessed arcane power and would react in supernatural rebuke if presented to a ruler-elect who was not fit. The treasures did not stir on their silk cushions as they were waved under Naldo's face. He was, so it seemed, fit to rule. The crowd cheered, drowning out the thunderstorm. The cavalcade withdrew to the palace. The next day, they would process to the Astropathicae for the subsequent round of mumbling rituals. The storm did not let up. Rain pelted into the evening, and more flamboyant auroras marked the heavens. Tense and unnerved, Priad withdrew Damocles to their apartments. At midnight, an aide from the staff of Lord Militant Farnsey came to them and requested a private interview with Priad.
"My lord wishes it known that there is some alarm in the visiting dignitaries," said the aide.
"I see," said Priad.
"The weather, the lights in the sky, they seem to be more than portents. Omens, perhaps."
Priad shrugged.
"Great war, brother," the aide said uncomfortably. "There is disquiet in the city. In the low quarters there has been some rioting. Also, reports of apparitions and visions stalking the streets. Murmurs in the warp, unsettling the Guild Astropathicus. Unrest is growing."
"I have noticed as much."
"It is feared the forces of fate do not wish this coronation accomplished," said the aide. "If it continues, if it grows, the Lord Militant and all the off-world guests will be forced to withdraw from Iorgu. My lord trusts that the acclaimed Iron Snakes will escort them to safety if that becomes an issue."
"I serve the Emperor and his vassals," Priad said, remembering his chapter master's instructions.
"Good," said the aide. "The Lord Militant will be delighted to know that."
By dawn, it was very much worse. Panic-induced riots had scoured through the city's suburbs in the night, despite the brutal response of the magistratum, leaving several wards in flames, smashed and unpoliced. The vast crowds now filling the avenues and boulevards of the central quarter had become protesters, not worshippers. They chanted for help and for release from the curse that had fallen on Iorgu, even as the magistratum's riot trucks hosed them off the streets with their water cannons. Lightning had struck the steeple of the Astropathica, killing 42 adepts and injuring scores of others. Unextinguishable corpuscent flickered and burned around the pylon tops of 18 city towers. It was said the silkmaker's quarter had been entirely abandoned after a terrible phantom had been glimpsed roaming there. On Priad's behest, Cools had made contact with their orbiting battle barge. The transmitted picts he had received in answer were troubling. 6 satellite towns around Iorgu City showed signs of rioting and civil unrest. Whole stretches of desert had bloomed with unseasonal foliage and bright flowers, turning the pink landscape green and white for thousands of hectares. The deluge had washed fresh, shallow tides into the basins of the old dry seas. Chapter 5. Lord Militant Farnsey didn't send an aide this time. Surprisingly, he came in person.
"Rioters and common filth snap around the palace and rise in numbers. We are departing the planet."
"We, Lord?" asked Priad.
"The nobility, Sergeant. The worthy guests. Augurs say that Iorgu is about to fall in fire and damnation. We must not be here when that happens."
"Indeed not," Priad replied.
He stood at the head of Damocles, facing the Lord Militant and his gaggle of assistants and bodyguards. All of Damocles were now in full war gear, battle ready. Only Priad had his head exposed,
his helm under the crook of his arm.
I trust, then, you will escort us to the landing field and see us off-planet.
The Imperial Guard
is occupied supporting the local magistratum in putting down the riot. They have their hands full.
You'd leave them here, Priad said. Farnsey glared at him.
Get some notion of priority, Brother Sergeant. They are dog soldiers, and fighting is what they do. We are nobility, and we will be afforded every respect. See to your duty and get us out of this hellhole.
Of course, said Priad, turning to his squad and preparing to issue them with instructions. A tiny, gleaming missile flew into the apartment, low enough over the heads of the Lord Militant and his entourage to make them duck in consternation. It came to a halt and hovered in front of Priad. It was a perfect human index finger, machined in gold. A soft, focused hologram, tiny enough to cup in the palm of one hand, materialized in the air above it. An image of a man in a black robe.
Brother Sergeant Priad, the hour is nigh, crackled the voice of Mabuse through miniaturized Vox relay speakers. I call on you and Damocles. I have found the why and the who.
Can you proceed without us? Priad asked quietly.
Yes, brother, but without you I will not succeed, and Iorgu will perish.
Are you exaggerating for effect, Mabuse?
No, replied the little hologram. I am underestimating.
Damocles stands ready.
Follow where I point, and find me, said the hologram as it dissolved.
The golden digit swung around in the air and waited impatiently. Damocles, arm up and set for combat. Follow me. There was a loud clatter of readying weapons.
What are you doing? Where are you going?
Farnsey bellowed as Priad led the squad out of the apartment past him.
I have a real duty to perform, my lord, Priad snapped.
You'd leave us to the mob? How dare you, Astartes? I am a Lord Militant. You will conduct me to the landing field in safety.
Priad turned back for a moment.
I suggest you dig in and lie low, my lord. Damocles cannot assist you at this time.
What the hell do you think you're doing? Raged Farnsey.
Getting some notion of priority, lord, said Priad.
Farnsey's curses followed them down the hallway. He would report them, discredit their name with the chapter master, ruin them, and ruin their reputations. The threats bounced off Priad's armor as harmlessly as raindrops. The guiding digit led them down through the sprawling bulk of the royal palace. Some rooms and hallways lay deserted, some showed signs of ransack. In the corridors they passed servants and aides who had pilfered what they could take and were busy getting clear, or the halted baggage trains of departing nobles, stewards calling out for servitors that were unlikely to respond. On one colonnade walk, PDF troopers were fighting a losing battle to secure shutters across window spaces blown in by the storm. Lightning splintered the darkness outside, and rain drenched in through the opening. They passed a hall where hundreds of palace inhabitants were kneeling in terror as agitated hierarchs led them in desperate prayers for deliverance. The spinal elevators were choked and occupied, so they made their way to a service lift in the western side of the palace spire and commandeered it. The palace staff, waiting to use it, fled the moment the great Astartes appeared. The service lift deposited them in a deep-set garage bay of slimy rockcrete. The wall-set lights flickered as the main power source fluctuated.
Secure transport, the little holoform of Mabuse said.
Most vehicles had gone. Laden, overcrowded transports were queuing up the exit ramp. The majority of the remaining vehicles were too small to take the whole squad.
Here,
cried Cylon, reading off his auspecs. In a private side bay sat several of the lift litters and repulsor barges used in the coronation procession. Amongst them was a long-hulled land yacht of luxury build. Liveried servants were struggling to load travel caskets and baggage aboard it.
Vacate the vehicle, Priad barked on speaker.
Some of the servants ran, dropping the luggage they were handling. Others froze and gazed at the approaching space marines in blank dismay. Pindor and Natus shoved them out of the way and boarded the yacht.
Powered up and set to go,
Pindor voxed back after a moment. Priad gestured Diognes and Xander forward to throw off the baggage already stowed.
What the devil do you think you're doing?
Wailed a voice. Priad turned.
The Princess Royal of Cartamax, clad in a floor-length fur, her face pale, was rushing towards them, flanked by half a dozen less than eager bodyguards.
"That's my vehicle," she declared, glaring up at the brother sergeant.
She barely came up to his elbow. Priad was amazed at her brazen outrage. She seemed to have no fear of the towering warriors. Or maybe, he considered, her fear of the situation outweighed her fear of the Astartes.
"We need it," Priad said simply.
"Damn you," she cried. "It's mine! Mine!"
"Lady, please,"
one of the bodyguards whimpered, keeping his eyes fixed on Priad and his men, and his hands very obviously away from his own sidearm.
"Please, they are Astartes."
The princess slapped the man so hard he fell over.
"You will not take my transport," she told Priad.
"I have already taken it. Calm yourself and return to the palace compound."
"You will escort me to safety, then. You serve me."
Ah, now, that was it, Priad realized. She wasn't afraid of them because she didn't understand them. Raised in the rarefied atmosphere of a high court, she had been educated to think of the Astartes as servant warriors, servants of the Imperium. She was royal-born, so undoubtedly they had to serve her. Such marvelous arrogance.
"Go away, now," he said.
"Do you know who I—"
she began to say.
"Go away now,"
Priad repeated. She gave an indignant shriek and shot him, point blank, with a micro-laser from under her furs. The blast scorched his chest plate and flashed warning sigils across his visorscope. Cylon and Akon had their bolters aimed at her in a heartbeat. She gasped and backed off a pace, incredulous.
"Go away,"
he repeated as calmly as he could manage, trying to ignore the urgings of the target cross that filled his view and framed her face.
"Lady!"
a voice boomed. The golden digit now hovered between Priad and the princess. Mabuse had boosted the volume of its vox speakers.
"I advise you to run away now. Right now. Do as the brother sergeant instructs you."
The little hollow form glared at her.
"Why? Why?"
she choked. The hollow form of Mabuse shivered and dissolved. It was replaced by the hard light of a crest insignia, the rosette emblem of the Inquisition.
"That's why."
She ran, wailing. A salutary lesson, Priad thought. Even someone haughty and thick-skinned enough to be unafraid of the Astartes hides in terror from the Inquisition. Chapter 6 Pindor ran the yacht out of the garage bay into the streets. Xander and Diogenes had been forced to walk in front of it to clear the jumble of transports from the ramp. Once they were through, the two warriors reboarded, and the yacht sped clear down the boulevard. Monsoon rain was falling in swirling curtains. Weird electrical effects underlit the low, sinister sky, and Priad saw at least 5 city towers struck by lightning in as many minutes. The road was littered with the detritus of rioting, and overturned vehicles burned in the rain. Dim figures flashed by in the shadows, fleeing down the pavements and walkways. At one junction, the bodies of 9 magistratum officers lay broken on the roadway. Priad's sensors detected sporadic gunfire from neighboring streets. For 1 50-meter section, the street-level windows of a tower showed not their passing reflection, but a clamor of open-mouthed ghosts, screaming at them from the rain-streamed glass.
"Golden Throne!" cried Andromach. "Did you see that?"
"No,"
Priad lied. The yacht swooped east, along the main city highway, up and over a humped-backed bridgeway that ran across a stately park. The daum trees in the park were on fire, but the leaves weren't burning.
"Turn east,"
Mabuse voxed.
"Head for the sacred mound."
Pindor struggled with the yacht's controls. They were unfamiliar, and his massive, gauntleted hands were too big to manage the dainty, knurled levers and throttles. He tried to steer the yacht onto the wide avenue that rose through the midtown towards the area of the mound, and ran them a glancing blow along a section of crash barrier. The impact showered sparks into the air and left an ugly wheel down the side of the luxury transport's hull. In quick succession, 3 lightning strikes brutally stung the roadway nearby, one to the front, the other 2 to the left. They left scorched blast holes smoking in the rockcrete. The electromagnetic pulses left them dazed and blind for a second, and the golden digit fell to the deck, dead and inert. A second later, and it rose drunkenly back into the air, the hollow form reigniting.
Come on, Mabuse foxed.
Dear God, Emperor, Pindor mumbled.
Priad looked out. A human skeleton, its bones made of polished ebony and its socket eyes glowing with a ghastly yellow radiance, stood on the roadway ahead of them. It was 40 meters tall. Damocles threw open the top hatches and started to blaze at the monstrous thing with their bolters, white tracers ripping the wet air. Andromach fired an incandescent blue blast from his plasma gun. Undamaged, unflinching, the skeleton thing took a step forward.
"Stop wasting ammunition!"
Mabuse all but screamed, his voice tinny and shrill.
"Go through it! It's just a glamour, an apparition!"
"Do it!" Priad ordered. Pindor threw the throttle lever to full ahead and drove the yacht at the nightmare's black tree-trunk tibia. They all braced for impact. None came. They were clear and gone, heading up the avenue. The gigantic phantom had vanished into the storm. The sacred mound was massive, its apex crackling with corpuscent. Damocles abandoned the yacht at the base apron and advanced at double time up through the lashing rain onto the old stone causeway that crossed the perimeter ditch to the main entrance. Mabuse was waiting for them under the lintel of the wide doorway. He held a las pistol in his real hand, and the fused, unrecognizable remains of several corpses sprawled on the flagstones around him. Mabuse raised his golden hand, and the roaming digit flew up and snapped back into place.
"Come on,"
he said, turning to move into the mound. Priad saw he carried what seemed to be a heavy knapsack on his back.
"Would you care to tell me what's going on?" Priad asked.
"There isn't really time,"
Mabuse replied curtly.
"Those bodies. Who did you kill?"
"I mean it, Brother Sergeant. There isn't really time."
As if to underscore his words, a salvo of autogun fire whipped down the entrance tunnel from within, the large caliber shells ricocheting off the stone floor and low roof. Natus cursed as several rounds struck his armor. Priad ran into the gunfire, his bolter juddering in his fists. On his visor, the ammo tally dropped. The target cross jumped and flickered as it searched the green gloom for a body. A flash of muzzle discharge, hot white against the emerald background. The cross locked. Priad fired, and a human figure tumbled out of cover with such force it bounced off the wall behind it. To his side, Chiron and Xander cut down two more ambushes. In seamless formation, Damocles swept into the inner atrium. Natus and Akon covered the back, Xander and Cylon the exit ahead. Pindor and Andromach advanced into the center of the hall. Priad knelt to examine one of the bodies. A human male, a local. Nothing especially significant about him, apart from the fact that 30 seconds before he had been brave or foolhardy enough to open fire on a squad of space marines. Priad's bolter fire had all but turned him inside out.
"A looter?" he asked.
Mabuse leaned over Priad's shoulder and reached out with his golden hand. The ring finger projected a thin, searing fusion beam almost a meter long that grotesquely peeled the corpse's flesh away from his forehead. Priad shuddered as he saw the rune branded into the front of the skull.
"Cultists,"
Mabuse said, switching off the fusion beam.
"The inner brand, the bone burn. In all my years of hunting these devils, I've never found out how they do that. How they brand the mark into the bone without blemishing the skin over it."
"I've never seen its like," Priad admitted.
"It's the mark of a powerful and ancient cult," said Mabuse, matter-of-factly. "I've terminated their activities on 3 other worlds. I was dismayed to find them at work here."
"And how did you find that out?"
Chiron asked. Mabuse turned to the apothecary and smiled.
"Don't tell me. There isn't really time."
"Indeed,"
nodded Mabuse.
"Besides, there are some things you don't need to know. To keep it simple, a notorious and well-backed cult is active here on Iogu. They carried out the murder of the old queen for one simple reason. They wanted a coronation."
"What?"
Priad snapped.
"Why?"
"Because only during a coronation would the stasis locks of the sacred mound be disengaged and the heirloom treasures of Iogu removed for the ceremonies."
"They're after the treasures."
"No, they're after what lies under the mound. What the treasures hold in check."
Priad rose.
"If there's anything that makes me want to crush a man's head, it's riddles, Mabuse."
The first settlers of Iorku, the first monarchs, bested something here. Something they encountered